Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, this is Adam, who you might know as one of the hosts of Monkey Tennis, the podcast you're about to listen to.
And this is Bex, who long-time Monkey Tennis listeners may know as the voice of Monkey Tennis Series 1's fake ads.
We're interrupting your pod to tell you about a brand new podcast from the both of us called Film Club.
Born out of a search for a fun, cheap night in together, we filled a jar with film categories. Each week, we pick one category and then a film each, based on that category.
This two-person club has now expanded to become a podcast, and episode one is available now wherever you get your pods.
Episode one has a whiff of Partridge about it too. Our category was films based on a TV series, so my choice was the Armando Iannucci-helmed Steve Coogan starring in The Loop.
And my choice? Well, you'll just have to listen to find out, as we turn two people and one jar into endless film possibilities and invite you to join our film club.
Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or via twitter.com/filmclubpoduk.
Now, back to my past self and Monkey Tennis.
I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
Monkey Tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey Tennis?
With his stupid Ewok head.
Blah, 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 Nolsey.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey Tennis?
A total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey Tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey Tennis?
Motherfucker. Gary Wilmot. Okay. Sue Cook. Okay. Dale Winton. Okay.
Monkey Tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
Hello once again, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. We are about to take a look at a man called Michael. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Nick Alder.
Regis will hammer you on the small print.
And Tom Stab.
Plant one on him, Nolsey.
Great.
So, Tom Stab's at the helm of this particular episode.
I am indeed. I was quite happy to get this chapter because we've speculated quite a bit before, during the recording of this time, whether we would see Michael in this time at any point. There was quite a lot of speculation from fans and stuff like that. Just a quick question. Who had actually read Nomad before this time went out?
Me.
Not me.
No. So, I guess from you two, there may have been some speculation about whether we would see Michael, whereas you, Tom, probably thought we're not going to see Michael because of how clear they are in the book that he is a man who died.
Yeah, but of course they have since said as well that they do have plans for Michael, don't they?
Yes, they have. So again, this kind of leaves the door open.
They being the Gibbons brothers.
Yeah. Which is smart, I guess. You want to keep that door open for Michael because he's a fan's favourite. But as I said in the commentary for Alpha Papa, a character like Michael you have to use quite sparingly. I think the exact quote they were saying, like, the more you use him, it's diminishing returns.
And I got the impression that even with Alpha Papa,
they felt that they were right on the edge of it being too contrived that he would be part of that story. So I think their standard of what's a realistic way of reintroducing Michael is much higher than us as listeners, watchers.
So it's a strong start from Alan in this chapter. Humility is my watchword, and I'm one of the humblest broadcasters you'll find.
This reminded me of I'm So Humble from the Pop Stars Never Stop, Never Stopping soundtrack. It's basically the same joke over a whole 3-minute song.
I enjoy the fact that he thinks that people assume his life is all about lunch with Ranson, dinner and drinks with Dimbleby, lazy barbecues round at the Chegwins. And he's also keen to stress that he's one of those celebrities that befriends non-celebrities, which is, of course, a kind of excuse for how he has Michael, a friend who is dead.
Michael, I also think their friendship is that of an acquaintance rather than a friendship as well.
Well, it's master servant basically, isn't it? Wash yeah, all my
that,
car.
All that.
So we've got some Alanisms here, kind of, I guess, like Spoonerisms. There's a normal Peter and a standard Andrew as well, which is, you know, yeah. Terms that he uses to describe like the normals out there, I guess.
A man on the street. Average Joe, yeah.
Yeah. So what does Alan/we know or don't know about Michael? So the things that Alan goes through, he says that he's an exceptionally low achiever. Well, I guess we can agree that part is true. He compares him to a rat as well. Yes. You're never more than a few feet away from a Michael, and that given the chance, he will breed like mad.
Yeah.
Again, this is kind of to go with Alan's point of what he thinks about the working class, basically, isn't it? A naturally promiscuous man, and that the only reason he didn't have a ton of bairns was because he sustained a cock injury in Iraq.
Oh dear.
Now, obviously there's been a bit of speculation about whether Michael was ever in the army. I think this could be an extension to that lie.
Actually, I agree, yeah.
He has got a ton of bairns, but he just doesn't see them. And so a cock injury in Iraq is the easiest way to explain away anything about to do with that.
So Michael was told to leave school at 9 and learn a trade.
I also love, like, you know, yeah, he's one of 9 children, but a crucial footnote that says this is all conjecture or guesswork. There's actually no like proof for any of this. He's just assuming, which makes you think that he's essentially absolutely like deriding Michael's character without any of it being based in reality.
Completely fictionalized.
It feels like Alan knows nothing about Michael pre the Travel Tavern years. Yeah. And even though they've then had a friendship over several years since then, he never even bothered to find out or ask.
Yeah, there's a build on that says, we never spoke about this family, about his family, and I've never been able to find the time to look into it. So I'll just assume that this is probably what he grew up like. This was his standard of living.
Also the vagueness of saying, Michael was posted to a few places and probably saw some action.
Yeah.
Yep, at 16, he met some officers at a Join the Army stand, a car exhibition at the NEC. Again, conjecture. Can you remember any of Alan's examples of how soldiers at the arming stations lure people into conversation? What the line is that they use, again, one that Alan kind of makes up.
No.
Cool jeans you're wearing. You know what's even cooler? Firing guns.
That's not a million miles away from some of the army adverts you still get on telly now, really.
Yeah.
So, again, like to do with the kind of questioning whether Michael was actually in the army and whether he actually saw any combat, I've done a bit of a deep dive on Age Watch. So Michael goes to the NEC car show and speaks to the army guys in 1969 when he was 16. So that would make Michael today, 66, if he were alive, of course, 44 when he sat on a steak and kidney pie in Alan's hotel room, 48 when he drove to Cardiff and had full sex with a woman, and 60 when he did a shit in a box / died.
That's a great timeline. Michael's greatest hits.
So yeah, do we believe Michael? Because then it kind of skips to him working in the hotel. So with the Iraq war, where Michael supposedly got his cock injury, remember that's what Alan says, conjecture, mm-hmm, I guess, mm-hmm, he got the inspiration, so that's where he would have got the inspiration later to name his bike Desert Storm. And the Iraq war ran from August 1990 to February 1991, so are we to assume that Michael was in the army for 22 years, because that's when he would have signed up in 1969? So that's a long time, and I don't think necessarily, if that's true, that he was in the army.
I think that's feasible if you're the sort of person that's worked your way up the ranks, but I think it's a safe bet that Michael would not have worked his way up the ranks. 20 years later, he's still a private.
I can imagine that he had campaigns that were 22 years apart and that he had a lot of downtime or sort of, you know, was on standby for much of that 22 years. Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing is with Michael, he's a bit of an odd character, not the smartest and a bit reckless. So I don't know how long his career in the army would have actually lasted. And
I could imagine him getting a dishonourable discharge like within the first year.
and
crucial, for doing a shit in a box.
Yeah. one of the cruxes this timeline is built on, namely that he went to join the army at a car stand exhibition at 16, is a detail that Alan has made up completely.
Yes, so, that is it is key to remember that.
Yeah.
So we're now in the Travel Tavern, and Alan says it has all the hallmarks of a top London boutique hotel, which includes 24-hour reception, standard.
Yeah.
Complimentary shoe polisher near the lifts, which are also complimentary. Mm-hmm. And a savvy clientele that wanted 5-star service for a 3-star price. And my note here is, don't we all?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's the dream.
Yes, another TripAdvisor mention here as
indeed,
well.
Indeed, yes. Alan does advise that you keep away from the TripAdvisor reviews because a handful of unhappy customers have really gone to town on them. Alan meets Michael one night in the Travel Tavern as he's attempting to use leftover cigarette butts to create a super fag.
Brilliant.
Super fag!
Which I'm a big fan of. One thing in this section particularly I would have really liked to have seen in I'm Alan Partridge, because it creates such a great visual gag, I guess, is Alan and Michael running around the hotel bar to see how many beer mats they could collect. So we skip on a bit, and Michael's getting his job at the petrol station.
We know that Alan helped him get that job, right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And Alan insists that the only reason he goes there is not to hang out with Michael, but to get coffee, fuel, or chalk. And he likes to repeat that quite a lot. Coffee, fuel, or chalk.
Yeah. I mean, his words would be, that would be pathetic if he was just going to hang out with Michael, despite the fact that's very much the reality.
He would never do that. He's doing that.
Yeah.
Although he does eventually confess that he went there to talk to Michael because he wanted to discuss topics such as what would happen if you put a grenade up an exhaust pipe. So I took to Google and popped in what would happen if you put a grenade up an exhaust pipe. And is it, do you pronounce it Quora? Is it Quora?
Like
the question and answer site. The closest I could find was, will putting a cherry bomb in a tailpipe cause damage to the car? The reply from Roger Helberg in May 2017. Okay, so this guy has replied to 1,500 questions on Quora.
Who's got the time?
And his answers have had nearly 300,000 views. He said, the shrapnel might kill someone, and if the fuel tank is mounted in the rear near the tailpipe, the explosion and fire might blow the tank and destroy the car. Not a particularly bright idea. So there you go. That's what would happen. I guess if
sensible advice.
I mean, if you put a grenade up there, if a cherry bomb's going to do that, imagine what a grenade's going to do. It's going to absolutely obliterate it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to ask yourself some serious questions if you're needing to look up that answer on the internet. But
like, is this a good idea or
not? It's the world we live in.
Worth just mentioning again that Alan obviously got Michael the BP job. That's confirmed here. And equally also got him the radio station security job. So very much carrying Michael with him.
I do like we get some insight as to what happened after the BP garage closed when it turned into a US style car wash and Michael was out of work again. He refused to work there because he said that he had bad hands. I don't know what bad hands are. Is it that they've done bad things? Or is it that there's some kind of injury? I'm not sure which.
Yep. It's definitely not an injury because, plot twist, it turns out that Michael is very good at shucking Brussels.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So do we think his hands have
Brussels
done bad
or
things?
Shucking Brussels sprouts?
I think he just doesn't
shucking the entire town of Brussels? I mean, that would take some quite dexterous handwork, to be fair.
I think he just doesn't want to wash cars for a living. And so what that means is that we finally found something that Michael won't do. It's just that that list of things doesn't include having sex with someone who looks like Bob Dylan or jumping off a pier to your own presumed death.
He won't wash a car.
Despite
the fact that he washes Alan's car.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not bad hands.
Well, but the reason given is that he's got bad hands.
Yeah, but we know that's a lie. Alan writes that he has lithe, supple fingers and shucks the sprouts into a colander with no little speed. It was so impressive that Alan cut the tip of his thumb off whilst carving the turkey.
So I guess the biggest plot twist here is that Alan's had Michael over for Christmas dinner, because we know that Alan basically spends every Christmas alone, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, that's it. Alan's got no family. No one wants to see him. I imagine the same is true of Michael. None of his 9 brothers or sisters want to see him.
I'm also imagining he's getting Michael round to basically just do all the dinner prep and then get rid of him.
Yeah, if nothing else, he's certainly getting him to do the veg prep, isn't he?
Michael, can you chop this and do that and wash this up? And cheers, gotta go. Yeah.
Wash my plates.
Yeah. Cook my roast.
It's not Michael that's washing the plates. After lunch, he says, I'll put the dirty crockery back onto the tray and leave it outside my front door for my assistant to collect.
Of course, we should have known that.
Sorry, Michael. Yeah. Lynn's already claimed plate duty.
So on the podcast previously, we've talked about our ideal British breakfast or cookie. And as fans of Peep Show will know, in a very dramatic Christmas episode centered around whether cauliflower cheese is a traditional side to a Christmas dinner. Spoiler, it's not. So question to the group, what is your ideal Christmas lunch? We're talking meat, trimmings, drink, are starters involved? What's for dessert? Talk to me about cheese. Go.
There's a lot to unpack there. I mean,
this could be a whole bonus episode. Yeah, episode
perhaps what we could do is go for what we think is our most controversial
inclusion. I like that. I like that.
What is canon for you, but you've had to debate, you've disputed it with other people?
Actually, I don't think there is anything in my world.
I can't think of anything that I would consider.
It's a very conservative but excellently prepared dinner at the Alders on
there. I think the big thing about the Christmas Day food, it's all about kind of how you're mapping out your meals over the day, because I think depending on what time of day you have a breakfast compared to what time you have, like, are you having a Christmas lunch or is it a Christmas dinner? All those sort of things, I think they all have a knock-on factor to what happens throughout the day.
And I'm interested to hear how the plan for Christmas Day dovetails with Stob's absolute hardline attitude when it comes to at what time a roast dinner is allowed.
Yeah, you've got very staunch views on this.
You don't believe that a roast dinner, what is it? It can't be after like 3 PM.
I would say that anything after 5 PM is madness for a roast dinner on a Sunday.
Why?
Is that including that's including Christmas? You wouldn't have it.
No.
Or so, are you softening your stance in reverence for our Lord Jesus Christ?
Christmas dinner is usually on the table in the Stab household at around 2 PM.
I'd say it's a smidge later in our house, but it's probably more like 3.
Basically, it's turkey, it's roast potatoes, it's pigs in blankets.
Yeah, and pigs in blankets are essential for
absolutely essential. This could be controversial. Does anyone have Yorkshires at Christmas?
Usually, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I'd throw them out. I mean, I sort of think the principle of Christmas dinner is it's Christmas dinner, have what you want. If you want it, have it.
But it's essentially roast dinner with all the trimmings and then some more extra trimmings because it's Christmas.
Is it ever cauliflower cheese?
Yes, no. Always cauliflower cheese.
Really?
It's not
traditional.
Yeah. It is traditional.
I will fight Mark Corrigan's down. and also, it's prawn cocktail starter.
Yeah, same. Same.
Keeping it 80s.
Or it's either that or it's parma ham and melon balls.
Nice.
That's also a great Christmas starter. Nick is not sure.
It's neither of those.
Is it Christmas pudding?
Oh no, God no.
Oh, it's
the Heston one with the orange in the middle.
It is, but I don't like it.
No, it's not good.
And then it's cheese at about 6-7 PM.
Oh God, yeah.
Bring on the cheese and biscuits.
God, the sherry is good.
Increasingly, it's a harder and harder fight to justify a sandwich before bedtime. the size of the roast goes up every year.
See, that's why we have our lunch at about 2 PM, because by the time you get to about 6-7 PM, you're ready for another feed. If you have it any later, that feed is getting later and later into
Once
the night.
Once you've watched Phil Mitchell be kicked down a flight of stairs or something, it's absolutely sandwich
says happy Christmas
time.
More.
Yep.
Great, really enjoyed that.
After that scintillating discussion on Christmas dinner, back to the chapter, we are moving on to Alan has helped Michael get a job at North Norfolk Digital. Alan agreed to vouch for him when the station was advertising for a security guard, but as it transpires, as we all know, the one thing that Michael failed to do is protect the security at the front door. As such, some people argued that Michael failed in his duties. They go on to argue he's ultimately responsible for the tragedy that led to the death of one person, brackets Michael. It's almost as if they're saying Michael deserted his post to help himself to wine and mini sausages, unwittingly allowing a deranged gunman to enter the building and take 9 people hostage. He let himself down. And I think that's a fair point. Basically, Michael caused his own death. In a way.
Yeah, he certainly did by jumping off a pier.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have been on the pier or jumping off it if the events of Alpha Papa hadn't happened.
True.
Yeah, to be fair, Michael isn't armed, though, so what would he have done even if he hadn't been tempted by wine and mini sausages? Which, let's face it, if we were all security guards, I'd be so tempted by wine and mini sausages. Even he deserves a break, and as I say, he isn't armed. So
I'd love to see you as a security guard.
Stop that.
Yeah. Can you not?
Nick, do it outside.
Okay. Do whatever you like.
Don't bother, mate.
Yeah.
So Alan says that despite him being a security guard, Michael jumped at the chance to twock the roadshow bus, which Alan says is a Newcastlian acronym for stealing, taking without consent. So I got in touch with a friend of mine who is from Newcastle, and I ran this phrase or acronym twock past her, and I think now we've got an actual direct response in the form of a voice note to confirm whether twocking is actually a real thing or not. So we'll play that in now.
Sorry, Tom. I'm sorry to tell you that I've never ever heard the word twok in my life. I don't know where you're getting it from, but it's not a Geordie word. I hate to break it to you, but that's just completely made up. Let me know any other words you want to know, but twok's not real. Bye.
So there we go, from an actual Newcastlian, as Alan says, confirmation that twok is not a Geordie word.
But twok is a word. It just might not be a Newcastlian word.
Right.
But then isn't Alan saying it's an abbreviation, it's an acronym.
Yeah. Consent, which is a thing. And also referenced, if anyone remembers, the 90s sitcom with Rowan Atkinson in The Thin Blue Line.
There's a
whole thing about twoking in there.
So I guess so what that means is that, yeah, twok is a thing, but it's not necessarily true.
A Newcastlian thing.
Yes. So, I mean...
Wait. So what are you saying? What does the word actually mean then?
Well, the word is taking without consent.
No, stealing. That's what I'm saying. Taking without consent, yes, that's an acronym. Are you saying twok, as in T-W-O-C, is a normal word?
No. I'm saying it's an acronym.
So we're saying it's not a Newcastlian thing. So, again, just a little bit of number crunching. As a podcast, we're at nearly 1.2 million listens. Out of this, 974,000 are from the UK. And out of this, 5,207 have come from Newcastle upon Tyne. So, although there are some Newcastlian listeners out there, can you confirm or deny whether twok is from Newcastle? We've got one opinion. Let's hear some others.
Yeah. Also, just to round off what Alan says about this, he says, it says something about the Geordie people that taking without consent is such a central part of their lexicon that they've grown tired of having to say it, and in a bid to save time have rendered it an acronym. So do bear that in mind when you hit us with your feedback. Alan's words, not ours.
Is there an interesting dig at the film script to set up this section as well?
I think I've got the same note.
Yeah, so I've highlighted Alan writes, then for reasons never fully explained, we boarded the roadshow bus. And I'd have to agree, that's never given any reasoning in the film at all, is it?
No, but I mean,
well,
it seems
they're
like...
kind of escaping, aren't they? It's a means by which they can escape the siege.
Yeah, I think the way they've included this in the book, I think that is a bit of a...
I think it's a witty...
I think they're having a bit of a dig at themselves.
It's a little wink, isn't it, that says, yeah, it doesn't make loads of sense, but it's a device by which they can escape the siege.
And similar to the haircut criticism, I think that's probably a bit of heavy criticism the film got online or something like that, and that's why they put it in there.
Yeah, they'll have read people's feedback on Twitter and read the reviews and probably noted that those are a couple of areas where people have raised questions, so they've chucked it in here as a bit of a yep, we know, but still sodger.
So we're at Michael's funeral now, and of course we don't actually see this in Alf Papa or any Partridge Output. He goes in on the bugler for not being very good, and of course the reveal is that he's 13.
Yeah, which is a bit of a tired gag, I think. Like
maybe.
No, it's always funny. All right. I enjoy it.
It is a bit of a tired gag, perhaps, but it's also very consistent with Alan's character, so you could
chap
look at it
chap
way.
Of about five, etc. Yeah.
Alan imagines what Michael would be doing now if he'd survived. He'd perhaps have a double life as a croupier in a casino in New Orleans, or maintaining a fleet of out-of-season pedalos in the Solent.
It's the second one, isn't it?
But do you like the way that links to, he also pictures his body all bloated and barnacled, all wedged between a fleet of out-of-season pedalos in the Solent.
And the big reveal at the end of this chapter is that Alan's actually sending out a coded message to Michael, if he's listening. And the reveal is that every first letter of each paragraph in the chapter spells out, "Hello, Michael, are you still alive?"
Which, to be fair, works a lot better if you're reading the printed book than if you're listening to the audio.
Yes.
Did anybody see that he'd started a paragraph with the word verily and become suspicious? Or,
no.
Like me, did you only clock this when you got to
the... Of course,
yeah. Also, of course, the other joke beneath it all is that if you wanted to find out if Michael was alive, you could just write it as a sentence in the book that you're writing. You don't have to hide it in the paragraph.
Yeah, it's similar when we come to discuss Angela, isn't it? There's a device by which he uses a similar technique to get a message
to send
out there.
Coded messages. Yeah.
That he's managed to subtly slip past the publishers.
So the chapter ends with Alan asking Michael if he's listening and to let him know that he'd like to meet up and talk about armoured vehicles. Alan just really misses his friend.
Well, he misses him, but he's also dedicated in an entire chapter to absolutely admonish his character. So
yeah, but I don't think Alan thinks he's doing a disservice with
he
this
called
chapter.
Him a rat.
I don't think Alan's got enough tact to realise that the way he's phrasing Michael's existence could be seen as quite negative. I think Alan thinks this chapter is quite a loving tribute to Michael. Yeah.
So
yeah,
what?
Yeah.
Oh, but life was tough in the slums of Newcastle, where Michael was born to a tinker and an unskilled seamstress, one of nine children.
And again, there's nothing. It's all guesswork as well.
Yeah, it's all conjecture.
But yeah, I think that rings true with Alan's character, that he wouldn't realise that what he's writing is perhaps bad and wrong.
Any other further notes on this chapter?
Well, just one thing. He talks about his father's funeral in this chapter as well, doesn't he? Saying that he was, it was suggested by some, I was unconsciously repeating the actions I'd taken at my father's funeral. Classic behaviour of someone who had failed to deal with past emotional trauma. So the question I had about this, because earlier in the book, he's talked about his father's funeral pushing far too much soil onto the casket. And there's some kind of similarly repeated action in this chapter. But obviously, Michael's body was never found, so... Can you refresh my memory, Tom? What is going on there?
Yeah, Alan accidentally throws mud into a hole because Michael's body was never found. There's no actual burial, and it's revealed that the earth he was bulldozing had actually been dug up for a rockery.
So is the conceit there that it's just like a random hole and he's just started pushing some mud in? Yes. Yeah. That's brilliant.
This will do.
I'm glad we nailed that.
So that's the end of this chapter, and we move on to chapter 26, The Gatwick Candidate. I believe there is a walk update at this stage.
Yes, so it's day 10 of the walk. He is covering 16 miles a day, which is relatively respectable when you consider some of the mileage he's been covering in previous
essentially
chapters.
Alan doing anything over 10 miles is quite good.
Yeah, exactly. So he starts in Pinner and he'll be ending up in Surbiton.
Yep, so we're back on the walk. We pick up Alan's journey again. So he's in London still after trying to doorstep challenge Harvey. And at first light, brackets, 10 a.m.
Brilliant.
He's
absolutely
up
brilliant.
And on his way. I just want to read quickly how Alan justifies the next leg of his journey. The most direct route back to my father's footsteps would be back the way I came, walking as the crow flies towards the Tilbury ferry port and on. But I'm not a crow, I'm a partridge, and so crucially was my father. So basically he's justifying being a partridge, he's using the justification of being a partridge as to why he doesn't go back the way he came, which would have been the quicker route, basically.
Yeah.
It's literally any excuse at this point, isn't it?
And in his own words, that's just the way I'm heading anyway.
quick one on the chapter title, The Gatwick Candidate. So I'm assuming that's a play on, is it the Manchurian Candidate?
Yes. Yeah. Which,
but does it actually link thematically?
I haven't seen it.
I'm not convinced that it does.
Well, not really. I mean, this is a chapter about a man walking to an airport and having, you know.
So the film isn't about getting, that.
Getting, no, not at all. The Manchurian Candidate, from memory, is about someone trying to become president or prime minister. We're kind of looking at Jez here, who's got evil
filmic knowledge,
evil as their main agenda.
Oh, what? Right. Jed on the film.
Sorry, I slipped into talking about Jed there. I should have carried on talking about the Manchurian Candidate.
So he also justifies it by remembering that he's been planning to check out Gatwick's brand of Regis Express for yonks, and he's been a member for years. I'd never heard of Regis.
I hadn't either.
I'd heard of it, but I must admit, I assumed it was like a hotel, whereas it seems like it's almost like a members club for people that don't have access to offices.
It's like WeWork, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, I imagine it's
a
budget
members
WeWork.
Club, or just like office space.
It's budget WeWork,
I mean,
basically.
It sits in my mind as something that I imagined was prominent in the 80s and I imagine had probably become obsolete by the
it's
time
traveling
not at all
needing to send faxes
not at
and
all
make phone calls, isn't it?
Because in the research for this I found out that it has over 2,000 centres and in 2018 generated a revenue of 2.5 billion.
Wow.
Good so business go. To get into. Great.
Yeah. Alan describes it as business cool and what it must be like working in Dubai after finding himself accidentally on Richard Keys's mailing list.
Brilliant.
So question to the group, how familiar are you with the broadcaster Richard Keys?
Not at all.
Hardly at all.
Vaguely, as in sports reporter and hairy arms. That's
brilliant.
All I've got.
I am very happy to do a deep dive on this because, first of all, he's an odious man.
He was in some sort of trouble at one point.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
Yeah, vaguely aware about that as well. Yeah.
So he was the face of Sky's Super Sunday and Monday Night Football from 1992 to 2011. In 2008, he was accidentally filmed on air saying about Estonia versus Scotland, "Daft little ground, silly game, fuck off," and in. Most famously, in 2011, him and Andy Gray were sacked by Sky after being caught off-camera making derogatory comments about referee's assistant, Sean Massey. I won't go into what they said, but safe to say, it's awful. And he is married. He married his wife in 1982. He has two children, but they separated in 2016 after he cheated on her with his daughter's best friend.
Wow.
Wow.
There you go. Richard Keys there.
According to Wikipedia.
No, all of that's true.
Oh, no, it's true.
He's confirmed it. Tom Stapp has confirmed
come
it.
Come at me, Keezy.
Yeah.
So it seems that the email list is an excuse for Keys to send his friends pictures of him in sunglasses on a Lilo or eating steak with Andy Gray.
And this is all in a footnote, isn't it? The Richard Keys email stuff.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So basically now he works in Qatar, I think, as a presenter out there. Keys doesn't know what BCC is, so everyone's emails are on that list. And Alan replies that he would be interested to see how Keys got on in the Islamic State of Qatar. And the other is the Islamist State of Qatar.
Very good, very good.
Alan is swiftly removed from the email list.
That's great payoff.
But crucially, Richard Keys does still send weekly updates, just not with Alan.
Eating steak on a Lilo.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't Richard Keys and Andy Gray do some kind of like after dinner speaking tour once they're both unceremoniously removed from Sky?
I think they still probably do, to be honest. So back to Alan's journey, and his next steps take him through the harrowing town of Harrow, the Greenbelt of Greenford, a woman called Brenda from Brentford, the Riches of Richmond, the Twits of Twickenham, the Teddy Boys of Teddington, the Fit for a King Kingston-upon-Thames, and ends up in a modest B&B in Surbiton. So a nice little bit of alliteration there, which I think Alan enjoys, and also I enjoy.
And it doesn't really make sense,
finishing it off with an extra little one at the end.
But it's things like, you know, to say a harrowing town of Harrow, fine, that makes sense. The Greenbelt of Greenford, fine, that makes sense. And then a woman called Brenda in Brentford.
Oh, yeah,
He doesn't go through a woman called Brenda in Brentford.
It's a lie.
Alan writes, if this sounds like a perfunctory description of a day's walk, what can I say? Nothing of any interest happens. If you've got a problem with that, take it up with the towns I mentioned or their elected representatives. And we've kind of talked about this a bit before. There are large swathes of action in the book where he just really skips through everything.
Yeah.
So it's that brilliant conceit that the writing is so poor, you'll get a real deep dive into some conversations, and then there are other chapters where he's walked like 20 miles and doesn't give you any detail about what's happened.
And lots of instances as well of him being like, if you've got a problem with it, take it up with, insert something that isn't him.
Someone else. Yeah. It's everyone else's problem, not his. Yeah.
Probably time to discuss airports, isn't it now?
Yep. And Alan describes Gatwick as the London airport it's okay to like. Has everyone got the details on how he describes the other airports of London?
Yes, that London Luton isn't in London and is barely in Luton.
Fair.
Stansted, an arrogant upstart.
Or Stansted,
yep.
Sissy, full of bankers.
Yep. And Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport.
I think he summed it up pretty well, to be honest, because with the exception of Southern Rail providing the service for Gatwick, I'm a big fan of Gatwick.
I do think Heathrow being an absolute tit of an airport is one of my favourite lines in the book.
Yeah, it's spot on.
So just as Alan pays £50 for a £2.99 whiteboard to write Harvey's name on, he gets a tap on the shoulder from Nick Knowles, who comes to Gatwick most evenings to drink, shop and eat.
That is
amazing.
So is it time to do a deep dive on Nick Knowles?
God, this is what I've been waiting for. I have to say, I think this is possibly my favourite chapter in the book, and probably because it so prominently features Nick Knowles.
So a bit of background on Nick. He was born Nicholas Simon Augustine Knowles. He was born in Middlesex in 1962. He hosted a number of TV shows, most notably DIY SOS, which has been running since 1999. But he also hosted the National Lottery Saturday Night TV game shows, Who Des Wins, Guestimation, Secret Fortune and Break the Safe. All sound dreadful.
Yeah, rubbish.
Contestant on I'm a Celeb in 2018, where he finished sixth. With that series also featured Edmonds, interestingly, who was eliminated first. He released a covers album called Every Kind of People in Christmas 2017, and that was part of a trend of daytime TV personalities releasing terrible Christmas albums.
I was going to say that must have been in the wake of Bradley Walsh, was it?
We'll get to that.
Okay. Yeah.
So I was well aware of Bradley Walsh, but I must admit, Nick Knowles and his musical career was a bit of a new one on me.
A lucky escape. Yeah.
I've not heard any of his output.
Anyone else heard any of it?
No.
Well,
I wish I hadn't.
For a treat for everyone around this table and for the listeners at home, we're going to play a little bit of it in now.
Sounds good so far, doesn't
for
it?
For rights and quality reasons, the section in the podcast may be shorter.
I think we've got a bit of a wait till we get to the vocal.
Yeah. Oh, God, is it a cover of Make You Feel My Love?
Yep.
Ech.
We'll cut this.
Come on, Knowlesy.
When the rain is blowing in your
mustache,
yeah,
and the whole world is
who did the original?
Your case.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
I could offer
who else has covered it? We'll get to that.
to make you feel my love.
It'd be a perfect soundtrack for some really loud drilling.
When the shadows and the stars appear, and there's no one here to cry.
He's really hamming that up, isn't he?
I could hold you.
It reminds me of David Brent when he
yeah.
does his own
oh, yeah,
single.
That's a good shout.
Make
yeah.
you feel my love.
Beautiful.
It's made me feel something.
So there we go. That is Nick Knowles' cover of Make You Feel My Love, which was a song written by Bob Dylan. Actually, in because you listen to that and you think it's quite an old song. That song was written in 1997.
I mean, Dylan's not even dead, but he'd still be he's still turning in his grave
well,
hearing that.
He wrote it, but Billy Joel was the person who originally released it. And it's been covered by such heavyweights as Adele, Garth Brooks, Brian Ferry, Kelly Clarkson, and Nick Knowles.
The quality control going off a cliff there.
Yep, there you go. So I think round the table, we can all agree that we're quite fans of Amazon one-star reviews.
Oh, yes.
So I've picked out a few highlights from the Amazon listings for this release. If you were to be shrunk down to the size of a pin and placed inside of a dog turd, this is what you would hear. This is truly awful. I bought this for my mum as a joke and she told me how bad it was after seeing Nick plug it on TV. It will probably go straight in the bin. If I die, play this at my funeral and you'll die with me. I was going to buy it for my nan but decided to go around and take a shit in her ear. That was posted on Christmas Day in 2017.
Wow, amazing.
And finally, right, this is quite a long one, but it really goes on a journey. So, okay. I'm going to level with you. I haven't listened to it. Not in the literal sense, at least. I know this Knowles guy, though. He's the guy in the tight black T-shirt with a hammer, and sometimes he's got a trowel. Sometimes he's in a tight white T-shirt, but usually it's black. He's got a strangely huge skin tone, and he often looks like he's about to pass a particularly troublesome stool. I don't really know much about music. I suspect he doesn't either. It all smacks of a midlife crisis, if you ask me. I remember him ranting on TV once. He was ranting about wallpaper. He hates wallpaper. He says it's nothing. He says it's just this thing that surrounds you. It surrounds you every day, but you never notice it. He says it's meaningless decoration with no artistic merit. Odd, then, that he should make an album of meaningless decoration with no artistic merit. I've checked the artwork, and it's all too evident that he made this album by largely leaning against some brickwork wearing a tight black T-shirt. He hates music, but he loves the idea of being musical. And unfortunately for mankind, he also has a disposable income that allows him to make this album. It's music for no reason, for nothing. Music for no one other than this guy in the tight black T-shirt who doesn't even like music. It is everything that is nothing. It is wallpaper. It is lettuce. And to a lesser extent, it is a cultural hate crime. It is a cultural hate crime.
Brilliant.
One star.
And just for the listeners at home, if you're interested in getting yourself a copy of the album, what is the album called?
It is called Every Kind of People by Nick Knowles.
Available in all good retailers now.
Anyone care to guess how many monthly listens he has on Spotify?
I'm gonna go optimistic, not because I want it to be true. I'm gonna say 15,000.
Okay,
Tom's I was down. Gonna go 10,000.
Okay. I mean, I wasn't being genuine with 200, but that's fine. I'm hoping it's not as high as both of their guesses.
Okay, well the answer is 2,200 monthly.
Better,
on Spotify.
Better. Yep.
So I'd like to do a little quiz based sort of around the idea of, you know, TV and film stars releasing albums is, you know, like nothing really new. So I've pulled together a list of recent ones and I have the sales figures. So this is going to be a little game of sort of higher or lower.
And this is all essentially the Bradley Walsh effect, we're saying. So
yeah,
he was successful and a glut of rubbish celebrities released albums following.
Exactly. Yeah. So that, it's nothing new. People have been doing it for years. But about 2 years ago, there was a kind
there's
of
a
trend.
Concentration.
Yes, exactly. So these sales figures are accurate as of Wednesday, the 7th of August, 2019. So I'm going to start by telling you the Nick Knowles figure, and then I'm going to give you the people afterwards, and I want you to tell me whether you reckon right. the sales were higher or lower. So Nick Knowles, Every Kind of People, sales to date, 7,747.
Oh, that's low.
That doesn't sound good.
So next up, Alistair McGowan released the Piano album. So how many sales? Higher or lower than 7,747?
Well, I'd start by saying I'm amazed Knowles sold that many records.
I would say higher because that is a staggeringly low number.
Yeah, I'm going to put McGowan higher.
Group consensus.
I'm with Adam, it's higher.
I'll go with the group, but personally, I think Knowles did a lot of promotion around his record. I think Knowles would probably... I'll go with the group. We'll go higher for McGowan.
It's lower, 3,948.
Oh, God.
Next up, Alexander Armstrong, A Year of Songs.
Really?
Higher or lower?
Definitely higher.
Yeah,
definitely.
Higher. Yeah.
I think higher. That probably did relatively well.
It is higher. 201,093.
Wow. Well done.
Bradley Walsh, Chasing Dreams.
Higher. That was
higher.
That was the,
way
wasn't
higher.
It like the biggest selling debut UK album of the year, I think.
It was like the biggest selling debut since like the Arctic Monkeys or something. Yep. Mental like
really?
That.
Really? Yeah. Oh yep. My higher. God. Okay, I'll go with these guys higher.
It's lower, 152,075.
Oh.
And interestingly, that Bradley Walsh album, the year it was released, was the biggest selling debut album of that year. The music industry is fine.
Staggering.
Okay, so next up, Jason Manford, A Different Stage.
Oh, this did quite well.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And he had a busy year because I remember he was touring comedy and he was in a musical.
So that's higher or lower than 150,000.
Was he not embroiled in some kind of sex scandal as well?
Yeah, he was naughty.
Yeah. Higher or lower? So higher or lower than
152,000.
I'm going to say lower, but I don't think it's lower by much.
Okay, yeah, let's go lower, but by a small margin.
It is lower. 18,535.
Okay, yeah, considerably higher, lower, okay.
Next up, Len Goodman, Crooners and Swooners.
Wow.
Please be lower. Although he is on Strictly, isn't
Strictly
he?
Strictly is, so,
yeah, but he can't
TV
promote
show
it there because it's BBC.
Yeah. Lower?
Lower.
I'll go with you guys.
Lower.
It's higher. 116,964. Yeah.
There is no accounting for taste.
This country.
I also think perhaps that figure's skewed by the fact that Len Goodman fans are more likely to buy it on a physical format.
Yeah, and also it's worth noting that out of all of these, it's the only album where it's not actually Len singing. It's like his compilation of...
So what, he's literally just...
Len presents.
It's just basically done a Spotify playlist and absolutely coined it.
Basically, yeah.
Len's pretend.
That's a bit like Sony.
That's a bit like there was a Michael Parkinson album that Warner did like 15 years ago or something. Yeah. But basically a double CD compilation of songs that he liked. But it's literally like the Michael Parkinson album, Michael Parkinson album with his face on the cover.
We've got a few signed copies of that at home, if anyone's interested.
I could do the new coaster.
And finally, we have Shane Ritchie, A Country Soul.
I'd say higher. Oh, actually, hang on. No, the Len one was massive. Lower.
It's got to be lower.
Lower.
Yeah, okay, lower.
I have a feeling it did quite badly.
It is lower. It's 8,572.
Sorry, Shane.
So there
it's
you go.
Not good news.
That's the end of the sales quiz.
Great quiz.
Fantastic.
What happens next is disappointing for everyone involved. So basically, Knowlesy grabs Alan and pulls him into the Wetherspoons of...
Knowlesy, you're a nickname terms of him now.
Yeah, Knowlesy.
Me and Knowlesy.
Big Knowlesy. Grabs Alan and pulls him into the Wetherspoons. 3 pints of lager later, Alan is drunk and spots Harvey.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of other like Nick things that I really enjoyed. There's a bit where Nick kind of asks Alan who when he's talking about Harvey Kennedy, and then in brackets afterwards it goes, actually, ooh.
Yeah, there are some great descriptions on there. He says Knowlesy is a big chap. His accent is a guttural East End oi-oi that screams, yeah. I am a physically violent man. There's also a description before then. He's a big man with a craggy face and an ease amongst labourers and tradesmen that suggests if the mood took him, he could summon them like Tarzan summons the animals and have them take you to pieces, violence-wise.
Yeah, he's like, he slaps Alan on the back. Alan goes, ha, I laugh. Not because it's funny, brackets, it isn't. It really hurts. But because I've always been afraid of Nick. Oh, so good.
I was also going to add, I like the detail when he says, Nick and I have 2 to 3 pints of lager, that Nick says it will relax me and insists that he only ever presents DIY SOS if he's DIY SLOSHED.
Sloshed.
Yeah.
So it all goes wrong. I mean, we could see this coming a mile off, couldn't we? Alan is now singing his idea to Harvey, but he calls him Mr. Nichols by mistake. Obviously a reference to Harvey Nichols.
Sorry. And also suggests that he would like to become the fourth Jew in his crowd instead of Jewel in his crown.
This very much conjures up when he's drunk in the Linton Travel Tavern. So we've kind of seen him like stumbling around, not being able to hold his alcohol, slurring his words. And this very much reminded me of that scene.
Well, I like Alan lists the reasons as his dehydration, tiredness, and, being honest, inexperience with lager as a drink, leading him to this state of intoxication.
Despite the fact, remember, he had been in Regis not that long ago having a shower so he could freshen up, so I'm not sure I entirely buy that.
Because he, and I quote, wants to be clean for Harvey. It's very creepy.
So Harvey, I mean, obviously has had enough of this and just pushes past him. And then Alan tries to get Nick Knowles to beat him up. Yeah. Plant one on him, Knowlesy. Lay him out.
But he didn't. Nick Knowles just pretended to not be with him. And the absolute final line in this chapter is absolutely brilliant. On Nick, he's basically a big, horrible git of a man.
Yeah. I haven't got any other notes on this chapter, so if anyone, don't know if anyone else has, or should we move on?
There's just one passage that I quite liked where he's talking about airports in general, and he paints quite a poetic picture with a great payoff. I'll just read you a bit of it. It says, the telltale thunder roar of a plane taking off. At first, I struggle to hear myself think, but I think it's okay. I just turn up the volume in my mind. And then, almost instinctively, I find myself standing bolt upright, saluting the winged beast above me and yelling up to it at the top of my voice, good luck, large friend, take wing and fly, for the skies are yours now and you are free, free to soar and swoop, to glide and gambol across the very face of heaven until you touch down, weary yet elegant, in a land far, far away. And with that, Ryanair flight 9853 to Cork is gone.
Yeah, brilliant.
I like the detail about him turning up the volume in his mind as well. Yeah. That's again like his brain is separate to the rest of him.
And now chapter 27, Upon the Wings of a Child. I believe there is a walk update, so I'll throw over to Nick.
If you put an R, actually, after the O and the N, you've got porn. And then if you move child in front of it, this chapter actually says child porn. That's not good, is it?
How's that walk update coming on, Nick?
So, should we cut that?
No,
what that. The fuck was that?
That was brilliant.
Are you mentally unwell?
I love it.
That was, sorry about that, listener.
So, chapter 27, this is day 12, it's now Wednesday, and he's going to cover 8.6 miles today, and we'll be travelling from Gatwick to East Grinstead.
So Alan is pondering a tattoo across his forehead that simply says, why do I bother?
That's because he's in a pretty crummy mood, isn't he?
Well, actually, he's in a branch of Ready to Munch.
But he then says, known by the French as Pret-a-Manger.
So, yeah.
I think that's another deliberate Nesquilk style.
Yeah.
So Alan's justification / denial for this is that he's gone on a 4-day detour based on assurances by a business associate.
Again, it's everyone else's fault except his. Yeah.
At least he got to spend the night in Gatwick's wonderful Ibis Hotel, and he says it's worth every one of its 2 stars.
Well, actually, I looked. It's got 4 stars on Google from over 700 reviews. So not terrible.
3-star.
So he awakes from a grouchy sleep. So we find out what lager he's been drinking the day before and what lager of what Nick Knowles' lager of choice is as well.
Yeah.
So if we see him advertising Grolsch soon, we'll know why.
He's cleaning himself with Head and Shoulders in a sink. So that's a nice.
Well, no, he's cleaning his last pair of functioning underpants.
With a much needed sink wash. That's a very important detail.
The results were impressive. Admittedly, they were never going to come out spotless. But what I can say is that they were a genuine improvement in both
stains and stench.
In terms of stain and stench. Brilliant.
I like as well that it's not his last pair of clean underpants. It's his last pair of functioning. So presumably he's worn holes.
What's happened to the other ones?
And he's been walking for what, 12 days?
I think Brian took all the others, didn't he?
Yeah, that's a good point. Brian or a group of teenagers.
Yeah.
There's one more important detail on the pants as well, that they aren't even dry. He's washed them in the sink and put them straight on and gone to Pret.
Oh, God. I can only imagine what that must feel like.
There's every chance that in a couple of hours they will be dry, though.
So Lynn calls Alan and she's excited about read receipts, which I don't know if you can go around the around the table. That's definitely the worst, most passive-aggressive thing anyone can do with an email. And it's immediately delete if someone does that.
Yeah, always hit no. Do you want to give a read receipt?
No.
No. Who needs a read? Like, the only time I think a read receipt is acceptable is maybe in the legal profession.
I've never come across it, to be honest, as a phenomenon.
Really?
No.
It's very rare, but...
Yeah.
When it's the mark of a moron.
Yeah.
So Alan's employed it. Actually, yeah. No, maybe Lynn's employed
it. Is it worse than saying best?
Thanks and best. Best is... Thanks and best is the worst sign-off. Also, I tell you what, now that we're on an office thing, does anyone else get annoyed with this? When people, like, put in their signature, like, a thanks and their name, instead of typing that in, like,
yes.
A kind of part of the signature.
Laziness. Ultimate laziness. Yeah,
it's not good.
I do that.
You are the worst.
Because I'm saving time.
No, but... You should either personalise that.
Why does that matter? Just thanks. Yeah. You're going to say thanks and then your name anyway, aren't you?
Some people you need to say thanks, Tom. Some people you need to say cheers, Governor T-Boz. You know, there's different names for different needs.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Can't believe you're one of them.
Also, please, if you're one of those people that gripes about the fact that everybody says, I hope you're well, stop being such a bellend about basic human politeness.
Yeah. Lynn gets excited about this and that she's only just got over 1471, which of course is 1471.
Does he describe it as 1471?
In the audiobook, right. 1471.
Yeah. Like, I was going to say, because nobody calls it that. Yeah. Great.
Right, so question to the group. Can you remember all the people that he gets a read receipt from?
Yes, I have the list here. So it starts with Gary Wilmot.
Okay.
Sue Cook.
Okay.
Dale Winton.
Okay.
Ainsley Harriet.
Okay. Julia Bradbury.
No.
Okay.
Philip Schofield.
Okay.
And Eamon Holmes.
Right. Can you read those again?
Gary Wilmot.
Okay.
Sue Cook.
Okay.
Dale Winton.
Okay.
Ainsley Harriet.
Okay. Julia Bradbury.
No.
Okay.
Philip Schofield.
Okay.
And Eamon Holmes.
Okay. Right. That is absolutely, in the audiobook, that is probably my favourite bit. I love it so much.
It's very, very funny.
So Alan is about 70 miles from Dungeness at this point, and it leads into a section that I think is quite random and probably one of the weakest sections in the book, I think, where Alan is flanked by some giddy kids who think that he's walking and raising money for Alvin's Foundation. Don't really have a huge amount on this, but I didn't find it particularly great.
No, there's a couple of nice subtle literary bits in the book, though. So when he's talking to Lynn in part of the same call where he's checking the read receipts, he says, so they all know I'm doing it, and they all know, and then he's put in square brackets, when I finish the walk. And then there's a big bit of consternation between him and Lynn about whether he said if or when.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's put in the book, he said, if you look at four lines, you'll see quite clearly that I said when. But then when you go back up four lines, you can see that he's inserted the word when in square brackets.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so he definitely said if. Mm. Great.
And there's the reveal that Alan has a weekly video call with some fellow presenters when Sunday Politics comes on and after Eamon Holmes has finished his breakfast. So the people on the Skype call are Alan, Eamon Holmes, John Stapleton, when allowed, Peter Sissons, and a hairy biker.
Hasn't bothered to learn which one.
That's totally the gag, isn't it? He doesn't know which is which. Yeah.
Can you remember the reason they're becoming less frequent?
Yes. It's because Eamon Holmes insists on doing his from the bath.
And it hasn't gone down well.
While he eats sliders.
Yeah. I think that detail is crucial. Is it worth dwelling on some of the questions that they discuss in their Sunday Skype club?
Well, I've got them written down here. Is it okay to hug a crying child? What if the child is 15 and a girl? Or it takes place in your dressing room and you've taken wine? Or if the child's parents are present but temporarily distracted? If the child needs applying a thigh bandage, only when you do it you notice that she's wearing lipstick and the high bandage is made out of lace and looks more like a frilly garter? Or that the child isn't upset but you're trampolining together and the kid does a brilliant somersault after weeks of trying and you realize all he she wanted was a well done and a pat on the back, or that the child is a chimney sweep and has become lodged in your chimney and is asking, no, pleading for you to grab him by the legs and pull him down and his parents aren't present and you're only wearing shorts because it's hot? My favorite bit of this is when the hairy biker says the hairy biker tends not to join in, claiming it's not difficult, you just don't touch up kids.
Well,
or is it a child porn ring?
Ah. upon the wings of a child.
Yeah.
No.
That's probably not that.
I do like the bit where he calls teachers blithering scum.
He does hate teachers.
He does have kind of the second attack on teachers.
Yeah.
He's not afraid to go off on a teacher.
And the writers of the book draw Toby Young in at this point as well, saying he was lunching a couple of years ago with writer slash broadcaster slash agitator Toby Young, and that Toby had basically come up with, and on Toby's advice, Alan created a weekly feature on my show called Shame on Them, Shame on Them, where he singled out an unorthodox teacher and gave out his or her name and address on air.
Won't spend too much time on Toby Young, but whilst doing my research on him, I did find this line on his own Wikipedia page.
He's a bellend of a man, isn't he?
Wait. Young is believed to have edited his own Wikipedia page 282 times in the decade leading up to January 2018.
282.
That's probably because people are putting defamatory things.
That's what I was going to say. Are people sabotaging it and he's correcting it?
I mean, either way, brilliant.
Yeah. But as a result of that, they can now say this and it can't be disputed because it is true. And you've got an edit history, presumably you can check.
There are two other bits I really like in this section when he's walking, being followed with the kids. They've been asking about sandwiches and stuff. I love the phrase, I'm getting razzed off. And then he writes, realising my route takes me right, I duck off at a delicious rice angle, helping myself to the packed lunch I'd agreed to look after as I walk away. So he's stolen lunch from kids dad. That is brilliant.
Brilliant.
And then Alan is spending the night at the Lark Guest House, run by Dave and Ashley Lambert. They're a gay couple, so their sense of humour is not for him.
Yeah, however, his real interest is in Scientology, which has its UK headquarters based in East Grinstead, although I did not know that. Place.
I was going to say, I didn't fact check that. Is that actually true?
Yeah, so it's a place called Saint Hill Manor, which was bought by L. Ron Hubbard in 1959. He lived there until 1967, and it has had $16 million worth of work done to it and was finally completed in 2015.
Oh, I think it's like kind of like a massive country
it's
house.
It's enormous. Look at if you Google it, like, I think I've seen pictures. Massive. Yeah. And brilliant. Well, not brilliant, but that's what Alan says about.
I also enjoyed the bit about the gay couple whose sense of humour is not for Alan. I come to realise they've been talking about caravanning the entire time. I did start to wonder if it might be a gay sex term that Dale Winton failed to include in the glossary he did for me.
I love that he's made a glossary for Alan. Great. That's really good.
What comes next is a heavily redacted paragraph that I think, rather than us just trying to regurgitate it, as we do with every other joke, we'll play in the audio clip here so you can enjoy it for yourselves.
I'm more than happy to give my own critique as I see it. And that's just for starters. At every bath time, apparently. And another... Aldi. Tactical firearms team. Needless to say, at the last laugh.
What I like there is that that they've clearly redacted things like the phrase "I had the," which there'd be no reason to get rid of. I had the last laugh.
And I also like the fact if just the bits that you do either read or hear, I can't figure out what the actual paragraph would be either.
Of course.
Feel like that's obviously a very deliberate thing. There's no way it pulls together.
I wonder if they've ever actually written it.
Probably not.
To have things like bath time, Aldi, and tactical firearms team.
Anything else on this chapter at all?
Only that this is the beginning of the night sweats that are explored more visually in this time. He wakes up and his sheets are sodden with perspiration, like sodden.
I think it's also worth mentioning that he passes the Queen Victoria Hospital, briefly wondering if he should pop in to get his foot looked at. He writes, "It now hurts a great deal multiplied by a million." But he rethinks, writing, "Going to casualty for a cut foot, dear oh dear, how would I have coped in Vietnam?" But I think with the beauty of hindsight, he probably should have got it looked at there and then.
Yeah.
I noticed that he ends this by saying, "With the exception of light bulbs, Hyman's, and my heart, which has been broken into a million pieces by a woman called Angela, everything's fixable. I miss Angela." There's a bit of a pattern here where I think quite a few of the chapters, or some of the chapters in this book at least, have been written so that they could be slotted in any order.
Yes.
And then they just add two lines at the end, which tie it to the next chapter. The same thing with Michael as
exactly
well.
Exactly the same one. Yeah.
And Edmunds, I think, as well, possibly. I think it's only...
Yeah, you could almost have those chapters written, just ready to go, and then just slot them in based on how you end and begin the
Especially
previous
chapters. Especially if you think, it's a 31-chapter book, he doesn't start the walk till chapter 10, and you have these totally separate standalone chapters on Angela, Michael, his father... you've got at least three or four where they're specifically about a person, so...
I think they were probably floating chapters during the writing process,
could have gone anywhere.
Just slotted them in where they made sense.
So that leads us on to chapter 28, My Angel. Angela. Which is probably, I think, the grossest, queasiest chapter in the whole book. I mean, we'll get onto some of the descriptions that Alan goes into. But
yeah, it's pretty grim.
It's not nice, is it? So, yeah, chapter all about Angela, as played by Monica Doolan. Her credits include W1A, Catastrophe, Inside Number 9, Black Mirror, and she won a BAFTA for her portrayal of Rose West, Inappropriate Adult, which I saw and was brilliant. So we see her in Alpha Papa, and she, you know, plays quite a prominent role in Mid-Morning Matters. I'm a big fan of how Alan describes her. Hers wasn't an obvious kind of beauty. You had to put a bit of effort to spot it, particularly if she'd had a couple of snifters the night before. But take your time, be prepared to look at her from a wide range of angles, and you would eventually strike gold.
There's also a little bit about his attitude towards receptionists, and a bit of a callback to Susan, I guess, from I'm Alan Partridge, saying, one of the things I love most about receptionists is they have to be nice to you. He also then says, it's vital that members of these professions, often women, but it's also now legal for men to smile warmly. Not accepted, not commonplace, just legal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he says that a quiet word with the office manager from one of the more senior members of staff should see them being shown the door within 24 hours of a grievance. And I thought, he's definitely done this, hasn't he?
Yeah, that way.
Yeah.
So a genuinely upsetting piece of terminology from Alan as he describes the first time he tongue-shagged Angela. And unfortunately, he doesn't leave it there.
It gets a whole lot worse.
He goes into details about his kissing technique. When you've been snogging as long as I have, you get a pretty good feel for the strengths and weaknesses of your technique. I really don't really want to go into details. Does anyone?
From a hygiene perspective, he's keen on Murray minting to ensure that his breath is always fresh. I mean, Murray mints are such an old person's sweet. In no way do they strike me as kind of being providing freshness in the mouth.
Yeah, that seems like this sort of thing. Your gran might have a box of Murray mint somewhere or something.
Yeah, it's never Murray mints.
Yeah.
Alan describes himself as an all-rounder. But he has one flaw, other than dribbling, is that he tends to overlean. On first dates, when a woman's not been briefed, this will usually mean she's forced backwards onto the floor.
No, that briefed.
Yeah, I'm just going to warn you, I will lean.
I'd love to know what that briefing looks like.
Yeah, like, and we're about to commence tongue shagging now, and I need to warn you, I do overlean.
Yeah, as well as, footnote, I also dribble.
Alan and Angela snog for 8 to 10 minutes in their Frenchie sessions.
Everything about it is bad.
Including that they often take place during the show and when Simon is there. But don't worry, he has his magazines. Which reminds me of the Simon doesn't mind, fuck him. Mid-Morning Matters. Yeah.
Can we talk a second about Alan's ratings as well? He says, it's just as well there's more to love than giving someone an arbitrary mark out of 10 for how attractive they are. So what if I was a 6 and she was an 8? Or if I was an 8 and she was a 6, brackets, which is what it was. Yeah. So question to the group, is Alan an 8?
No.
Do you
think so?
No. What? How is he an 8?
I think that, because he's played by Steve Coogan and he's a dashing man who looks after his hair. I think you could argue that Alan is an 8, but it's the fact that he's willing to point it out is the joke.
I think maybe physically he's an 8, but unfortunately he's dragged down by his personality. average comes out way lower.
You maybe have a bit of an imbalance where obviously like Coogan himself is genuinely in good shape and obviously looks after himself, but the character of Alan obviously has a fat back, build up a fatty deposits. Mm-hmm. I don't think Alan in the world of the APU is in as good a shape as Coogan is in real life, so it is a bit conflicting, but maybe if Alan were to dress better and not have often such ridiculous hair, he probably would elevate his numbers a bit as well.
So I'm going to have to press you to rate Alan Partridge's attractiveness out of 10 in that case.
Well, I give him a 7.
Fair enough.
7? Again, generous. I'm going like 4.
And that's Steve, I'm giving you an 11.
Oh yeah, Steve is hubba.
They are the same person physically.
No, but I'm talking about the Alan Partridge, the character.
Oh, in the actual APU, it's a 4.
A quick follow-up question to the group. What magazines does Simon read to distract from this?
What Car magazine?
No, he doesn't. No, no,
I
feel no.
Oh, it's like, is it like those like word search booklets that you can buy and stuff like
I think he would probably read something as like a kind of Wired, because he wants to be in that kind of tech world with young people where you get free breakfasts in the places of, you know, where you work. Mm-hmm. So yes. He's able to daydream. dream of a life that unfortunately he's not able to obtain.
I wonder if he might also get Mad magazine imported from America or Cracked.
I was thinking some kind of comedy magazine.
Yeah, and possibly a combo of Private Eye in order to look smart, and because of him and Lucy's Doctor Who watch along, probably a Doctor Who magazine of some kind.
Oh, yeah,
as well.
Yeah, good.
Maybe Viz? Would he go?
I can see him being a Viz person.
But maybe like Viz is slipped inside Private Eye, so he looks more intellectual.
Yeah. Yes.
So Angela is strong and has stamina. So that's his sex description of Angela, which I think is a description that he's mentioned before about her.
He definitely describes either their tongue shagging or shagging sessions in Mid-Morning Matters, doesn't he? Yeah, and it's equally quite grim.
For a while, he thinks that there's something wrong with her, but after rewatching the film where Michael Fassbender plays a fuckaholic, he concludes that it's just that he turns her on.
Also, crucially, Michael Fassbender, not Fassbender.
Oh, really? Is it?
Fassbender.
Angela and Alan move in together after 10 days of dating.
Why not?
And we learn that they have discussions whilst making love. Alan describes himself as quite a chatty lover and Angela less so.
And Tom, some people thought that them moving in together after 10 days was a bit quick, but it wasn't and they were wrong.
She might respond to the odd thing, but as a general rule, once lovemaking has begun in anger, she preferred not to be disturbed.
Anger.
And their pet names for each other. Sparrow is the name he would call her when they're making love, and Big Bird is the name she would call him.
Now, we've Alan's referenced Colby before. his dad's Colby. Not on an oil rig.
Yeah.
He's in the Cotswolds. But I don't think we've heard of Philip before, which is the other.
And also, what I also enjoy in the book, it says Colby brackets 15, and then Philip brackets, I want to say 12.
Which I also like, because earlier he was saying that one of the 8 deadly sins should be rising inflection, as if you've got a question mark at the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
So he's done his own thing.
Yeah.
Can you remember some of the highlights of Alan's rules?
I mean, remember, first of all, they were basically good kids. But Philip was short and Colby had spots.
One of the rules was that they have to go into the garden if they want to break wind.
Yeah.
It's important that they wash their hands before dinner.
Yep.
And be in gym jams by 8 o'clock, which, to be fair, is a rule I can support.
You do enact that in day-to-day life.
I also like that he requests they say grace before each meal. He says, as an atheist, I wasn't bound by this and could begin eating as soon as I sat down. And he's basically just giving himself a head start.
Is there one more, which is Alan must have dominion over the remote control?
Yeah. So he's effectively an absolute tyrant that gives them no freedom, and it's hardly surprising that they hate living with him.
But isn't this what he likes to describe as stepdadding 2.0?
Yeah, brilliant.
I love that in the exchange coming up where he's trying to work out what the issue is with this sort of family dynamic, that Angela is basically like a mute. It's like, is everything okay, Sparrow? What's going on? She just goes, too strict.
So Alan is living with Angela and her two kids. And everything is great, but the good times, sadly, were not to last.
I was going to say, what could possibly go wrong at this point?
Well, Alan will find a way. So who's got details on what happens next?
Well, I mean, it's an incident we've covered before when it happened in Mid-Morning Matters. He sent a text message to a lady after a visit to the local swimming bath.
Melanie, a woman from accounts.
Yep.
He wants to play her bum like the bongos.
It's the most foolish text message he's ever sent.
So we know from Mid-Morning Matters that this text was sent, but not a huge amount of context around why it was sent or how it came to be sent. But we find
That's right, you don't get the whole story
no,
in
you
Mid-Morning
don't.
Matters, do you? Yeah.
So this is where we get to paint the picture of what happened. Well, I guess it's kind of what Alan says happened.
Tom, paint the picture for us.
I'll get my brushes. So there's a work do at a local swimming bath, of course. Crucially, Angela can't swim. She had lessons as a child, but she said that she just kept sinking. The night is a roaring success. 4 members of staff turn out of the 16 who said that they'd attend. Luckily, Alan has brought along 4 juice boxes, which he invites the guys to sit in his car and drink them, including Melanie from accounts.
Even that is just... it's just weird.
Yeah.
Like, do you want to come and sit in my car and drink juice? It's just weird.
Melanie from accounts is up for it. And it turns out that she's texted Alan a picture of her in a dressing gown slightly open. And then one thing leads to another. And Alan sends a text saying he'd like to play her bums like the bongos. And Angela sees this text and immediately kicks him out.
Did Melanie stitch him up, basically?
Or did it happen?
Yeah. Or is there a world where actually she could conceivably have sent him a photo of her for a completely... non-nefarious purpose.
Well, if what Alan says is true and she's got a dressing gown slightly ajar, I think she knows what she's doing.
Mm.
My read on this was, I don't think Alan is making this up, because this doesn't end well for him, because, you know, he very quickly wraps up with, our relationship collapsed and she kicked me out of the house. It's like that he's not even tried to paint himself in a good light with this. So I think this is actual a reliable narration for a change.
All I've got left on this chapter is that Alan signs it off with a desperate plea for Angela to get in touch with him again, which kind of mirrors the longing for Michael to get in touch again with him.
Well, I like that he writes about the text messages. I tried to explain to her that it was just random banter between workmates. There's nothing going on between us. I could have just as easily sent those texts to a man. But Angela was having none of it and could be quite stubborn.
So once that's all happened, he says that but every cloud is said to have a lining of precious metal, typically silver. So in this case, he says it's good because he ticks an item off his bucket list, a 3-day watercolour break on the banks of Loch Lomond. I'm pretty sure we've covered him slagging off watercolour breaks to one of the callers to Mid Morning Matters as well.
But in Mid Morning Matters, he does talk about when he has the enforced break that he says it was his decision and he does go watercolour painting in Loch Lomond.
Yes. But doesn't he say it was a complete waste of time?
He says it's rubbish to someone who's considering it that comes into the show, I think,
Right, so I think that wraps up that chapter, unless anyone's got anything else.
Well, I think the other thing to add is maybe that he's still trying to communicate, and much in a similar way that he tried to communicate to Michael in coded messages in the book. He's using this book as a way to try and establish contact with Angela. There are several footnotes saying, call me, and... things like, I did talk with the idea of sending her a message in this book, but my publisher felt it would be inappropriate and I agreed. After all, even if I did still have feelings for her, and that's not something I'm prepared to discuss publicly, would this really be the forum in which to say, Angela, if you're reading this, please talk to me when I walk past you at reception. I always try to catch your eye, but you just look down as if you're reading something, even though I know you're not.
Yeah, and while I think of it, another thing I wouldn't have my publisher's print is a sign off along the lines of, I think about you all the time, how your nose wiggles when you laugh, how you go blotchy after a hot shower. I just want to touch you, smell you, hold you tight in the pouring rain. You complete me, baby girl, and then just a single kiss, which in a weird way reminded me a bit of there's a section in Mike Skinner's book, the Story of the Streets, where people are forever asking him who the famous person in he got together with, and he says, you know, I can say that it categorically wasn't Rachel Stevens, which I believe must be a way of saying it was Rachel Stevens, but I can't say that.
Allegedly.
So that brings us to the end of our penultimate Nomad episodes. Thanks so much for listening. If you're enjoying what you hear, please do give us a 5-star review or recommend us to a pal. And get in touch, thepartridgepod@gmail.com, facebook.com/thepartridgepod, on Twitter it's @thepartridgepod, on Instagram it's @monkeytennispod, and the Monkey Tennis hotline is open for your calls on 07923 600 017. We'll be back with the last of Nomad, but for now, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Call me a baby girl.
I'm off to play Adam's Bum Like the Bongos.
Awful.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I watch them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, bright blessed day.
I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
Monkey tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey tennis?
With his stupid Ewok head.
Blabber on him, Nosey.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey tennis?
A total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey tennis?
Motherfucker. Gary Wilmot. Okay. Sue Cook. Okay. Dale Winton. Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.